Welcome to Narratology. Each episode will offer unique insights and perspectives from people countering the narrative. We seek to tell stories that bring a critical lens to the events shaping our present and our past. We will bring activists, artists, influencers, advocates, and innovators to you, and together engage in powerful discussions. I'm your host, Charles Stevens. Greetings, everyone. Welcome to Narratology, the CNP podcast. I have been really looking forward to this episode since I first invited our guests. It's been an episode that I've both been nervous about because I'm joined with two people I respect deeply, but also because I have this amazing opportunity to talk about something that feels very personal, something that really connects so much of the work that I've been committed to, seems like throughout my life, but definitely the founding of CNP. And we're going to talk about some topics that I'm just really, really passionate about. So I'm going to try very hard to sound smart, which is going to be difficult with the guests that we have because they're brilliant. And with that, I am honored to be joined with Chai Hughes and Michael Obi. My relationships to them are story in of itself. That's a whole other podcast. But we're going to talk a bit about their friendship, their experience, particularly in the Washington, D.C. Black queer art scene in the 80s and 90s. And we're just going to really invite you as our listeners to take this journey with us as we talk about some people that may be familiar with you. We're going to talk about some art. We're going to talk about some culture. We're going to talk about some politics. We're going to wrap it all up in this one podcast episode. So with that, why don't we begin with our guests? My first question is for Chai. Hey, Chai.
Hey there. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I was so both nervous to ask because I was like, oh, wow. But then I was also just grateful that you joined us. Tell our listeners about yourself. Who are you?
Charles, you know that that's a hard question. I will start with the vernacular of today and say that my pronouns are she and her. But who am I? I'm changing and evolving all the time, Charles. I'm not the same person I was 35 years ago, which is when the Renaissance was occurring. And so there are some things that have remained the same. And those are my core values. Kindness, real big on kindness. Joy, let's get the best out of life. Humility and openness. I consider myself a servant leader, which is why I found myself doing the things I did and still continue to do, because for some reason, it matters to me that we are at the table. When I've taken the opportunity to sit at the table, people have asked me to lead, and I have tried to with humility. And that's why I say I am a servant leader. Everything from the work in HIV to doing poll watching right now during this past election. So who am I? That's a little bit. My hobbies, I love gardening, writing. I still write, dabble a little bit in writing, and kite flying. So that's pretty much who I am.
Thank you, Chai. Michael Obi.
Mr. Charles. Hey, Charles.
You know what I realized, Michael? I have known you. It has been 20 years this fall. We met September 2000, if I'm not mistaken.
I was in graduate school at Georgia State and you were in undergraduate school. We were in class together.
I know.
It was a Black gay activism class. What was the teacher's name? You remember?
Dr. Laylee.
Yeah. She was a wonderful woman. I really got a lot in that class. I really did.
Michael, tell our listeners about yourself. Who are you?
Well, you know, kind of like Chai, I'm certainly very, very different than I was back 35 years ago, as we're going to be talking about this Black gay renaissance that occurred in D.C. I'm a college professor. I teach at Atlanta University. I've been teaching there for about 13 years. So it's a whole nother life than it was back then. One thing that I would say, you know, is that I never really considered myself to be an activist. You know, as I wrote down all these people that I, you know, dealt with, associated with, crossed paths with during that time, who I would certainly consider to be activists. I never really considered myself to be an activist. I guess I am an activist for students at this point, but I never considered myself to be an activist back then. And I'll go into that as you ask other questions. But I'm certainly a singer. I still sing quite a bit, a lot at church. I do some studio sessions as well. Back then, I did a lot more writing than I did. And some of the people that, you know, we're going to talk about, I'll talk about my songwriting with Larry Duckett, who was in Tongues Untied, and very, very brilliant, brilliant musician and poet. So I'll certainly talk about him. You know, I like to cook, you know, just cooked a huge, huge Thanksgiving dinner and considered to be a good Louisiana cook. That's where I'm from. But, you know, I'm kind of laid back and, you know, kind of slipping into being a senior reluctantly. And glad to be here with you, Charles. You know, as I talk about you all the time, I just talk about the great respect that I've always had for your intellect. When I remember meeting you and you were like 20 years old, I was like, geez, this is a brilliant young man. And I see what you've done over these past 20 years, and I'm proud of you and certainly just thrilled that you asked me to be a part of this.
Thank you for that, Michael. And as I've said before, I don't know what I've done to just have been so blessed to know you. Really grateful.
Oh my goodness.
Chai, could you share a bit about how you and Michael, how y'all met so many years ago? What?
So many years ago, you say? Okay.
How we met and fell in love.
Okay. And this is so funny because Michael and I did chat a little earlier this morning and we don't remember, but we know that there were a couple of people possibly involved, a woman named B Files, someone else named Papaya Man that were in our circle back then. We believe that it was in Atlanta. I lived in Atlanta back in 1980, 79, and I believe that it was then. But more so than how, I know that it was a space that we were in of mutual admiration for the love of live performance. And that was really a big part of our connection. And I think Michael and I, we just created this covenant of brotherly and sisterly love and respect. And that carried us through the years, so much so that when I moved back here 3 years ago, immediately when Michael and I met, it all fell back into place again, as if nothing had changed, because that foundation that we set so many years ago, decades ago now, remained strong.
I remember when you came to Atlanta, you were living in California, you came for a visit. That's been about 8 years ago, maybe. You came to my house. We had some people over. You came to the house and we stood in the driveway and just hugged with tears. And I'll never forget that.
Yeah.
You know, we've always had this special love. I remember when I first met her, I remember how beautiful she was. I was like, God, she's so beautiful. And I was like, oh my goodness. You know, and she's still as beautiful, even as we are in a later stage of life. She's still beautiful. And that beauty, I soon found, did not just go from her skin. It was all the way through. And I just cherish her and love her so much.
And Michael, too. I mean, you were a looker. You know, you were a looker then. And you know, now when I look at you, I see like a wisdom on top of all of that. You know,
I love you too. Okay. Enough about us.
Okay. I'm sorry. Okay.
Enough about our beauty.
So that's when we met.
Yeah, that's how we met.
Well, there's certainly a lot of fluidity in the friendship. A little bit of sexual fluidity happened.
Oh,
I will definitely say that.
But Charles, if I can say, that is one of the things also that attracted me to Michael, that he presented his whole being. He's not the kind of man who, because he is attracted to men, dissed women. If he saw a woman who he thought was beautiful, attractive, whatever, he let that be known. He was very comfortable with all aspects, still is comfortable with all aspects of who he is. I love that about him.
I hate to confess this, but when I first came to Atlanta, it was 1980, 79, 80. And the first people that I met, you know, who were, you know, in the life were women. So I was always around all these women. I didn't know any guys. So sometimes I'd be the only guy at the party. With all these women, I was like, God, these women are so beautiful. And interestingly, a lot of them saw that in me too, and not shy, but you know, there were one or two that I might have slipped off with, or three maybe. So I won't call their names. I won't call their names. But, you know, one thing about it, you know, in the space that we were in, you know, I was free to be myself, you know, because I kind of, you know, dibbled and dabbled on both sides and, you know, kind of did that kind of freely, you know. It wasn't like a thing. It was just kind of like what I liked. But, you know, in the time, I just formed some great, great friendships, and certainly Chai is at the top of that list. That's for sure. That's for sure.
Thank you for that. I am just smiling from ear to ear hearing this, all of this love. So if we could just shift a bit to Washington, D.C. in the 1980s, and particularly the Black LGBTQ community in Washington, especially the arts scene there at the time. Chai, could you share a bit with our listeners about what that time was like in Washington, D.C., what it meant being a creative, being a part of the creative community, and just really paint a picture for our listeners about what was happening?
I would love to. We called it Chocolate City back then, lovingly, a term of endearment. The city was somewhere between 70-80% African-American, and it did provide a safe space for the most part for us to gather. But, you know, we created art out of a need to claim an existence, you know, to move from the margins and into the light, both spiritually and holistically. And again, being in D.C., D.C. being so Black, the mayor, council people, community, it was time for us as LGBTQ people to move out of the margins, this Black experience, and bring our gayness into the limelight. And art really did allow us to do that. And it unapologetically, we showcased our love and our pain, our beauty, anger, politics, and as we used to say, our fierceness. That was our word back then. I don't hear people using it much now, but fierceness that we proclaimed and we were proud to put out there. Multimedia, I mean, you could find our presence in print, in, you know, Sharon Farmer, who is a renowned photographer, went on to be the photographer for, what's the president?
President Clinton.
Right, Clinton, right. And so, you know, we were there, we were out, we were doing so many things. And some of the venues that you could find us in, we did art galleries. There was, what was it, the Tibbs, the something Tibbs?
Thurlow Tibbs Gallery. I don't want to interrupt you, Cortai, but just to let people know who he was. His grandmother was a Black opera singer from like the turn of the century and left him this house and all this fabulous art collection. It's worth millions of dollars. And he was always a supporter of the arts back then. I had forgotten about him until you mentioned him. He's passed away now, like a lot of people we're going to be talking about.
Yeah, and he's, you know, passed away into obscurity, but the gallery was fabulous and people performed there. The National Theater, CD bars. I think when we begin to talk about Essex Hemphill and how he changed the bar scene in many ways into high art form by his presence and performing there. Libraries, the YMCA, and we'll talk a little bit about this, I hope, if not now, maybe another time, the coffee house.
I want to talk about that too.
Yeah, and there's a film being made as we speak about the coffee house and its importance during that period of time.
And the title of the film is Fierceness Served, the Enniskillen Coffee House, and I'm excited to talk about that when I get my turn.
Okay, I'll shut up.
No. When you finish, please. You finish.
Chai, before we go to Michael, sometimes in years or decades or in history, there are these singular moments that stand out that kind of represent that era, like an event or a conflict or just something that happens. And I was wondering if for you, if there is one memory that you have that you think captures that moment, the era, that period perfectly for all that it represents. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And if I may get a little personal with that experience, because I can't speak to what the experiences might have been for other people, but I think of when SinQ, which was performance group, Larry Duckett, Essex Hemphill, and I were part of, but when we got invited to the National Theater to perform, that was a highlight. And we were there to celebrate the first year that Dr. King's birthday became a holiday. That's kind of what I mean about us coming out of the shadow and into the limelight. You know, here we are, gay, lesbian folks at the National Theater. Our performance at that time was, we recited the I Have a Dream speech. To me, that was the culmination of presence, of us being there in our wholeness. That's the one, you know, that kind of took us out of the margins as LGBT folks and said, you know, we are part of this Black experience, so much so that you have invited us to be a part of this event at the National Theater to commemorate the first year of his birthday becoming a holiday. Dr. King's birthday was not always a holiday. That was something that was fought for. And we had a chance to celebrate that. And so to me, that was very significant.
Michael, I want to ask you the same question. Was there a memory or an experience that you had that you can share that captures that era or sums up so much of what was happening for you?
As I think about that, I think for me, it was my first performance at the Coffee House. We talked about the Coffee House. And if you talk to anybody who was involved in any of this stuff back then, they're going to mention the Coffee House. And I want to tell you a little bit about the Coffee House. It was like this performance space that was built out of a carriage house that belonged to Ray Melrose. And again, we talk about Essex, if we talk about Chai, we talk about any other people that I certainly want to mention before we get off this call, they would all have some connection to Ray Melrose because he was like the one who promoted, he invested money in people. I mean, he became my manager when I was trying to make records. I mean, he just was, and he was an activist, but he was all about, you know, creating these performance spaces for Black gay folk. And the Coffee House was like the first place, but it was kind of like a progression from the Coffee House to this club called DC Space. DC Space is a place where we all perform. Essex performed there. Wace and Chai, Chris Prince, other people performed. For me, it was that first time that I performed at the Coffee House. It wasn't a big space. It had a fireplace in one part of it. Then there was this place where they sold cider, and then there was a little upstairs part. You know, but I remember coming down to sing, and I was singing with Tom Minor, who was another person that I probably want to talk about. But the play, it was just packed, and the people, they didn't really know me because I was new to the city. But it was like they just embraced me, and they just, you know, so and these same people who were there ended up like following me throughout the whole years that I lived there, where I performed, they would come. And it was just a feeling of support and belonging that I had never felt before, particularly as an artist, you know, and in this gay space. It was really quite amazing, you know, and that's one thing that really, really kind of sticks with me.
Thank you, Michael. We've already started talking a bit about Essex Hemphill, but Chai, could you share with our listeners, who was Essex Hemphill and how did y'all meet?
Essex Hemphill was a presence, a force that made its way through DC and beyond. He was a complex human being. He was talented from follicles, you know, his hair follicles down to his toes. Everything he spoke was seemingly in prose and poignant. I say that he was a complex human being. We loved him as a presence, as an artist, and we held and continue to hold him in high esteem because he broke barriers. As I said, his prose, his poetry, in a seedy little bar would elevate that place to high art. People would come to, for instance, the Brass Rail in DC, knowing that he was, did you just grunt? Michael was at the Brass Rail.
Yes.
Okay. He was fearless in his writing and his expressions, but at the same time, he was fearful of intimacy. And I remember on Saturday mornings and days when our group would get together to rehearse and perform and create, he found a place where he could be vulnerable. And we would kind of say, you know, Essex, leave your diva at the door. Okay, we're here to create and to rehearse and have a good time. And after a few joints and some drinks and some good food, laughing and sharing stories. And you saw a different person from the one who was on the stage who had to be perfect and had to wow you, and did. He's an icon. I'm glad that you, Charles, recognized that about him and lift him up. So I thank you for that.
Michael, is there anything about Essex that you would like to share? And who are some of the other folks in that era of the Renaissance that our listeners may not be familiar with, but that you would like to bring attention to?
That's a great question, Charles, and I'm excited to answer it. Like I said, I came to DC. Chai mentioned B-Files, who was a good friend of mine here in Atlanta. She kind of told me about the performance scene up there, and I kind of followed her up there. I think I was about 25, and met a lot of brilliant people who became my friends, some of them to today, and some of them, again, have crossed over to the other side. But Essex was one of those people, and I want to call some names. Essex worked with Larry Duckett. Larry Duckett became the person who I really worked with artistically because we wrote songs together. I think I might have mentioned that already. But also Christopher Prince, Ron Simmons, who we lost this summer, Gideon Farabee, Steve Langley, who was a great singer. All these people were together, and they were just brilliant, brilliant, brilliant people. Chai, Garth Tate, Sweet Honey and Rock was kind of connected to that group, so we knew some of those folk. So it was just all these folk, and they were just so brilliant. And here I am, this kid coming, you know, kind of indirectly from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And I was like, wow. It just kind of broke every stereotype that might have been in my head about what Black gayness was about, because these people were just brilliant. There's one incident that I want to kind of share about Essex. Now, I like everybody else, admired him because he was so brilliant. And he, you know, his poems would just take you to another place. But I can't necessarily say that Essex had that same kind of admiration for me. You know, here I was, this kid with wavy hair and gold chains and gold jewelry and all this stuff straight from the South. And he pulled me aside to tell me that, you know, the people who probably all that beautiful gold that you're wearing, the people in South Africa are in oppression because of that gold that you're wearing. And he turned me on to this group of folks that were collecting gold to buy bullets for the people in South Africa so they could fight the oppressors. You know, I took off all my beautiful gold jewelry. I don't know what it was worth, and just donated it all to this organization at Essex, you know, suggestion, and have never worn gold since then. And it's been 35 years ago, or longer than that now, you know, a long time ago. I do remember that. I remember the way he walked. He had this walk. One friend of ours, a female friend of ours, used to call him the sex machine because of the way he walked. And Chai talked about his presence when he entered the room. He definitely had a sense of self that was evident when you met him. I want to talk a little bit about Larry, too, because Larry and Essex worked a lot. But Larry was, to me, was a creative genius. He was a brilliant keyboard player, brilliant writer. We wrote some great songs together. And I said, you know, from the beginning that I never considered myself to be an activist. And I kind of still don't. But some of the songs we wrote were very much, you know, about activism. There was this one song that we wrote called Totally Madhouse. It was, you know, your behavior is totally madhouse, so you better get your shit together. Your state of affairs aren't in order, yet you declare war in someone else's town. So it was all about politics and all that stuff. Unknown Road to Paradise was a song of hope for people dying of HIV that actually I wrote for a friend of ours who passed away. I don't want to call his name, but he passed away back during that time. And it was just trying to find something hopeful to hold on to. And basically what that song was about was that, you know, maybe as you have this death experience, you'll find yourself in paradise. So it was kind of activism in a way. Now, also, one thing that I remember about that time is when they were filming Tongues Untied, because Marlon Riggs was around and hanging around with us when they were filming. You know, again, you know, Ron Simmons, who was one of my closest friends, he was in it. Chris Prince was in it. Larry Duckett was in it. Wason was in it. Steve Lang. Can you think of anybody else, Chad, that was in?
Was Asante Saint in there?
I think so. But anyway, all these people were, when they were filming Tongues Untied, you know, they would get through filming. We'd be hanging out and going to the club and doing different things. And again, at that time, you know, I had no thought of the importance of what they were doing, you know, or what I was doing, or what anybody of even being a part of anything like this. And you think about, you know, the Harlem Renaissance, and you ask yourself, did Langston Hughes know that they were a part of something that was really special? But now that I, you know, reflect on it now, I realize, you know, how special it was, particularly when I think about the notoriety Tongues Untied has gotten, the notoriety that Essex has gotten, you know, and other people as well. Again, I just didn't think about it. You know, again, we're different people, you know, at this point in life than we were back then. You know, I was trying to be a rock star.
You know, as we traveled into other places outside of DC, and we would talk about what was happening there, and people would be in awe. That
right.
Gave a sense later on of, wow, I guess maybe that was a unique time. We were
right.
Just living it, not really knowing that, like when I moved to LA and I started talking about what we were doing in DC, people, that was not happening in Los Angeles.
Right.
That was not happening in San Francisco.
And it certainly wasn't happening in Atlanta, that's for sure.
Yes, in retrospect, we can look upon it and say that was an incredible time. But during that time, we were just living our lives.
Right. And one thing I want to make sure, Charles, that your listeners know is that, you know, when all this art was happening, it was happening right in the middle of the real AIDS crisis, you know, where there was no medicine that people could take and stay well. You know, we were doing this and watching people die. And again, many of these people that we've mentioned, you know, they passed away, you know, because of HIV back in those days. There was a group called The Four of Us, and there were two partners in that group who were both brilliant keyboard players and, you know, Christopher Prince was a singer, and then there was a female singer as well. But, you know, the two Toms, you know, both of their names were Tom, but they both played keyboard player, and they were partners, and they both passed away, but they were brilliant, brilliant musicians and songwriters and all that. And a lot of the art that they created, you know, was kind of motivated by what was happening around us. And again, you think about, you know, your 25-year-old self, and, you know, your 25-year-old friends are getting sick and dying, and all that happened in the context of that, which was, when I think about that, it's very, very interesting. Another person I want to mention is Dwight Talley.
Oh, he was right on the tip of my tongue. I was just going to ask you about
Dwight Talley. I have to
yes, pianist.
Dwight Talley was, I mean, these kids were, I mean, they were musical geniuses. The way he played, and again, had songwriting experience with for people before, but when I met Larry, it's like Larry could play notes on the piano and play, you know, just some chords and the harmonies that I could hear with these complex chords that he played. And we just created some of the best music, I think. And I think I'm a good songwriter. But the music that I created with Larry, to me, was definitely like some of the best music that we played. And again, just to kind of talk about the performance, you know, back to Ray Melrose. You know, Ray Melrose was like the father of all this. And when the coffee house stopped being a performance space, you know, Ray was a manager at DC Space. And again, we talk about DC Space. DC Space was a performance space where people like Evelyn Harris performed from Sweet Honey in Iraq. Jeff Major, who was a famous harpist who's married to Kathy Hughes, he played there. A lot of different groups played there, but Ray Melrose opened it up to groups to us like Essex, and myself and Larry performed there. I performed there with my band, Obi-Wan. I performed there as a solo artist. You know, he just opened it, you know, we all did. So four of us performed there. Wason performed there. So all these people who were part of the Renaissance, Ray kind of kept it going, but moved it from the coffee house to DC Space.
Audre Lorde graced the coffee house. Mm-hmm. When she was in DC for the Library of Congress, she was invited there. And afterward, she came to the coffee house. And it, I mean, the coffee house was really, yes, it was the essence of the movement.
Right. But my, like I said, my thought is that, you know, Ray kind of moved the whole thing and did very quite successfully. You know, and actually, I believe when he moved it, the whole thing to D.C. Space, and I think, Chai, you may have left D.C. by then. When did you leave D.C.? What year did you leave?
I think 86.
86. 85, 86. See, I'm talking about like 86 through like the early 90s, you know, when it was just really on fire, you know. And this was even after Essex had stopped, but there was so many different performers that, you know, who kind of focused on music, like the four of us who were really musical. And we also, got, you know, from there, we got to perform. There was another man I wanted, Cliff Robeson. Do you remember him, Pachai?
I certainly do.
Cliff Robeson worked for like the city of D.C. So a lot of these gay performances got to do like park gigs, you know, working in the city parks, you know, performing for festivals, things like that, because of Cliff Robeson. So it was like, you know, we just had all these doors open for us from people I would certainly call activists like Ray and Cliff and others. And, you know, I have to talk about some of the support musicians that I worked with who are not necessarily in the life, but they just supported us, like Dave Marsh and Jim Levy, who is a professor, music professor at, oh gosh, I want to say American University, maybe. Broderick Robinson, who was a drummer. So a lot of other people who kind of supported us in our art, you know, within this context, who were like, you know, friendly to who we were at that time as gay folk. I'm trying to think of who else did I want to talk. I know maybe I've gone a little long, Charles. But again, you know, one thing about it, and again, I got to mention Ron Simmons. You know, Ron was my great friend. He was Chai's great friend as well. And we lost him this summer. You're talking about a brilliant man and who also supported us in the arts and was a part of the arts. As I said, he was a part of, you can see him in Tongues Untied, one of the last times we spent together socially. There was a screening of Tongues Untied when I was in D.C. last summer. They interviewed him and actually called me up and all that. I'm like, I don't have any importance. I can tell you what it was like when they were filming it. I was not a part of it. But Ron was a great supporter of all of us. He invested time and money and advice, and he was so brilliant and all that. And he was a great friend. And that's the one thing about it for me that, you know, I formed great, great friendships during that time that, you know, that I cherish and that, you know, that is still very strong. And again, some of the people have passed away. But, you know, with Chai, you know, I mean, Chai is my sister. I love her. And, you know, Chris Prince. And again, I mentioned that the film, the documentary that they're working on. And I got to mention also Michelle Parkinson. We hadn't talked about her. Michelle Parkinson is a brilliant poet, director, filmmaker, just brilliant. They're all doing this. It's Michelle Parkinson, Chris Prince, Pamela Jafari and Wason Jones, who are putting together this documentary about the coffee house. And, you know, which to me, it was kind of like the starting place for all of this that we're talking about. And it was the coffee house. So they're doing a documentary about it. And, you know, I think, Chai, you're going to be a part of it. And I am too.
And I think that Charles will probably get it and screen it.
Yeah, well, yeah. And Charles. Maybe, and Charles, you know, I think, and I hate to bring this up, you know, in the public, but I think they probably want you to kind of be interviewed as they talk about what the youth or the new folk like yourself, the new activists, what is the new activism about? Is it juxtaposed the new activism to the activism that happened back in the 80s of this time period that we're talking about? So Charles, you got to give me your word that you're going to be part of that.
Oh, Michael.
You got to contribute your brilliance. You got to do it. You know, you're the one now.
Any last words for our listener?
Chai, you want to give your last words first?
Charles, you had posed the question, what must Black LGBTQ plus artists know today about the Renaissance? And I would encourage them to learn about it and take what's useful and mold it into what they need to do right now. But the important thing is to recognize that our community has ancestors and elders that you don't have to guess about their identity as in the Harlem Renaissance. You don't have to sit back and say, I wonder if they were gay.
Right, right.
What we did in D.C., we did out and open, proud people of the LGBTQ community. And we're here. Some of us are still here. And there's a legacy. That's what I would like to offer. There's a legacy.
What I would say, and again, you know, Charles, you know the admiration that I have for you is to young folk is to look at you and look at what you've done and what you continue to do and try to mirror some of that. You know, as you walk in your truth, you know, that's not always easy for folk in this straight culture that we live in. You know, model themselves after you. That's what I would say, Charles. You know? I'm serious. I mean, I'm very, very serious. You know, I remember first meeting you, as I said, and just kind of basking in your brilliance and, you know, but you are a strategizer, you know how to put things in action and do the things that you do, you know, and more than that, you know, walk in pride, be proud of who you are and be yourself. You don't have to be a certain way or look a certain way or act a certain way. Just be proud of who you are as you live your life. That's what I would say to young people and demonstrate that to the people who come after you.
What's beautiful is that we exist on a continuum. The work that happened in DC during the DC Renaissance is very much connected to the work that CNP is doing now, the Counter Narrative Project. I see the work that we do as being directly tied to that. And in many ways, Counter Narrative Project was born when y'all were at the coffee shop performing. You know, that moment when y'all were, you know, in that space and creating and imagining, that made this possible. That made this podcast possible. Like, this podcast wouldn't even exist if it wasn't for your courage and brilliance and bravery. It's just so amazing how all of this is so connected and tied together, because if it were not for what was happening, this conversation today couldn't even happen. So I'm just in awe of that. Thank you, thank you, thank you for appearing on this podcast. One last question. If our listeners would like to reach either of you, how can they find you?
I'm out in Fayetteville.
Yeah, don't give them your home address. Don't give them your home address.
Oh, no home address? Oh, okay. Well, always through email, chai@anetwork.org. chai@anetwork.org. Love to continue to just reach out and meet folks, connect. I love this generation. I love what's happening now. You have no idea the joy I feel when I see what's going on. I'm so proud.
Well, I live in Atlanta. You can email me, mikeoby1@gmail.com. And I want to kind of echo what Chai just said, you know, and again, I'm a college professor, so I see a lot of young people and mentor a lot of young people and encourage a lot of young people, a lot of LGBTQ young people. And, you know, I'm proud of them too. I think in a way, some of them, just their presence is activism, you know, because they walk in their truth. And, you know, and again, it's a different time now than it was back for us. But, you know, I'm just really proud of some of the young people that I've had the privilege of teaching and of being with and mentoring. You know, I'm proud of them. And I'm really proud of you, Charles. I can't say that enough. You know, I'm really proud of you.
Hey, Charles.
Yes.
May I add my Instagram? And it's at Auntie, and that's spelled A-U-N-T-E-A_Chai. And you can follow me there as well.
Chai Hughes. Michael Obi, thank you for joining us at Narratology. Thank you, listeners. We'll be back with another episode. Thank you all.
Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.